Welcome to New Narrative Southeast Asia Dispatches. I'm your host, Bonibel Ramatan, Editorial Manager for New Narrative. New Narrative is a movement to democratize democracy in Southeast Asia, and this podcast is one of the ways we attempt to do just that. A few months ago, we published a research report by Thetwai titled A New Feminist Narrative Towards More Inclusive Southeast Asian Democracies. There, we attempt to deconstruct and broaden our understanding of Southeast Asian democracy through a feminist lens. We try to look beyond representative democracy to uncover the relationship between democratic processes such as civic participation and gender justice, and how those two are strongly interrelated. In our more recent research by Octaria Asmarani, titled Structural and Systemic Factors Hindering Democracy in Southeast Asia, A Feminist Perspective, we explore the systemic and structural challenges that impede Southeast Asia's practice of inclusive democracy, still, of course, through a feminist lens. We explore difficulties such as law enforcement, surveillance, freedom of expression, human rights violations, and the rise of religious fundamentalism, and how those affect women and queer people.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. My name is Octaria Asmarani. You can call me Witrani, pronounced she, her. I'm New Narratives and Democratic Participation Researcher. Thank you.
That is Octaria Asmarani, New Narratives Democratic Participation Researcher. Rani recently completed her studies at SOAS, University of London. With a background in philosophy and anthropology of sustainability, she focuses on feminist studies that intersect with environmental justice, culture, and politics. Drawing from her experience in social work and community involvement, she strongly believes in the power of communal learning and sharing to address various structural issues.
Firstly, thank you so much for having me. My name is Kilaga, and we're pronounced they/them, and I'm with Justice for Sisters. Thank you.
That is Tilaga Sulatire, a founding member of Justice for Sisters. Tilaga is a community organizer and researcher. Their work focuses on gender, LGBTQIA+ related issues, and human rights. Justice for Sisters is a grassroots campaign organized by concerned citizens to raise public awareness on the violence and persecutions against Malaysia's Maknya or trans women community. In this episode, we will talk about the systemic and structural issues that hinder the practice of inclusive democracy in Southeast Asia, the cases in Malaysia, the role of research, and as always, the importance of regional solidarity. All right, thanks so much. We're happy to have you both here. We'll be talking about feminism and democracy, which is, Rani, you mentioned that that's the area of research that you do. So why don't we start there? Why don't we start with the research? Because, you know, You're not the first person to do this research in New Narrative, and you've kind of been following up on a previous research. So maybe you can tell us more about your journey from the previous research, which was called A New Feminist Narrative Towards More Inclusive Southeast Asian Democracies, and to your current research, which is titled Structural and Systemic Factors Hindering Democracy in Southeast Asia, A Feminist Perspective. So, tell us about your journey, Rani.
This explainer is actually the continuation of the first report, A New Feminist Narrative, which was written by Thetwai, our first democratic participation researcher. And basically, in this research project, we want to explore our understanding of Southeast Asian democracy from the perspective of feminist and gender justice activists in the region. And we want to discuss the challenges, the way they overcome it, as well as sharing our desperation and hope at the same time. So we hope that by studying the existing and potential movements in this region, it will hopefully help us to understand how we can strengthen the democratic movements in Southeast Asia. And talking about the journey, basically, the first report is quite lengthy. It's in the form of PDF of 10,000 words. But that report is very crucial for this research project because it serves as an introduction to this project. It gives the literature review and also how we perceive like the specific topic that we are going to have, like democracy, gender and feminism, as well as the personal reflections of that why, because Fatwa is the feminist activist and also researcher based from Myanmar, and I think it's important to bridge us into this explainer, which we decided to make it like quite concise, if I can say, in more like smaller pieces and in the form of like about like 4,000 and 5,000 words explainer, which hopefully will be easier to digest, because this will focus on the main theme or main topic, which is the sub themes that are already introduced in the first report, basically about the structural and systemic factors, and then about the daily challenges that these activists are facing, and also how are we going to envision about transnational movement. So yeah, that's basically it.
You are positioning the follow-up research as you mentioned the concrete examples, not exactly the concrete examples, but you used the phrase, you described it as in the original publication, it was more about the, yeah, like a global overview. And now you are talking about the structural and systemic factors and the, the daily lived experiences of these, of the activists, which is also, which also came up in the first research, right? So how do you, and of course you're going to be publishing a lot more research on this. Can you tell us more about the through line and what you're trying to achieve in the publication, the project at large, but also maybe in the each individual publications that you're working on?
Basically, these explainers are the follow-ups of the previous research that you mentioned. And It is quite specific, because these explainers are focusing on the testimonials and also lived experience of the activists that we are engaging with. In total, we have like 14 activists and also one focus group discussions and one community peer review, which in total make it 23 of participants, like research participants. And yeah, based on our engagement and conversations with these activists, what we are trying to achieve in this publication is to understand more about the democracy from the perspective of these activists, and just like see and learn from their own experiences, and to put it in the, like each explainer. So the first explainer, like this one, is basically trying to examine the structural and systemic factors, because from our participants, they told that they shared to us about laws violating human rights and gender rights, threats of freedoms of expressions, and also all of these are strengthened by religious fundamentalism, not only happening in society, but also in government. So hopefully this specific publication or this first explainer will give an overview of what's happening in Southeast Asia countries regarding gender rights, like the overall and maybe like the very basic overview of the situation itself. So it can serve as a reminder that what we are facing is very powerful and like holistic, if I can say it, very systematic. So this then can bring us to the next question of how the activists are working towards democracy. So we are, in the next explainer, we will focus on their daily experiences and also hindrances, so that combining these two, like the structural and systemic factors along with the daily experiences, we can try to you know, in vision or talking a lot more on how to collaborate and also how to foster solidarity transnationally within the region. So basically, yeah, we're trying to find out and explore more about democracy, reflecting on the activist experience. So yeah, hope that answers.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how you're highlighting and focusing. And I guess it's you know, it is due very much to the feminist lens that you are really, really, you know, emphasizing, putting out there about the intersections between the decline of democracy and the decline of feminism, like the decline of the increase of sexism, I guess we should say. Also the increase of feminism, hopefully, in the masses. But yeah, religious fundamentalism and, you know, again, bigotry in all its forms and the decline of democracy goes hand in hand. And the fact that you're pushing for feminism and a more comprehensive, more intersectional feminist lens to actually build this transnational solidarity, I find is very fascinating. You also mentioned several times about Justice for Sisters, and here we have Thilaga going to be talking more about Justice for Sisters. But before we go to that, Rani, maybe you can give a bit of context as to how Justice for Sisters has played a role in your research.
So Justice for Sisters is one of our research participants, and Thilaga was actually interviewed by Seth Y. And I found it really, really fascinating to read the opinions and also experience from them. So yeah, I think mostly the experience and also opinions from Justice from Sisters. And I also read the report, and it also helped building the series of explainer. I think it's just like important to understand the very, very context of Malaysia. So yeah, looking forward to hear more from Thilaga.
Thank you, Rani. Take it away, Thilaga. Tell us more about Justice for Sisters.
Right. So Justice for Sisters is a human rights group that works on the rights of LGBTIQ and gender diverse people in Malaysia. So we work towards a criminalization-free and discrimination-free Malaysia, region and world for LGBTIQ and gender diverse people. And we do this through evidence gathering, movement building, strategic litigation, and other advocacy strategies and tactics. I mean, of course, in keeping with our discussion today, I also thought I should add that our work is grounded in queer, feminist, and human rights framework. So the work that we do is really taken through these lenses.
I would like to hear a little bit about your own perspective relating to that, relating to, the queer feminist frameworks that you are heavily primarily working on. What are your thoughts on the intersections or like the effect of like when we see democracy as just, you know, as a very general without using feminism, and why it's important to use feminism, especially queer feminism, in analyzing or improving, shall we say, the state of democracy?
I think I wouldn't be queer if I didn't like invoke Michel Foucault. And I think when we look at, as I said, like, you know, we ground our work in queer feminism, or queer feminist ideas. I think firstly, we recognize that, you know, all of us as people, whether we are marginalized or we are not marginalized, we all have power, right? And this is exactly what Foucault reminds us of, right? That as people, we have power. And when we come together and unite our powers, then we can have something more transformative. And I think this is something that, you know, is very central to the work that we all do as queer people and as we all do as human rights defenders and activists, right? Where we constantly try to center the power of people, and we constantly try to remind people that they have power, and the power that they have can really make transformative changes. So I think in that sense, I see, how queer feminist analysis really gives us a lens to interrogate and analyze powers at all levels. Powers within us, power within society, how, you know, for us, of course, how gender is constructed, and also power at the, you know, and also in terms of how it creates social hierarchies and how these social hierarchies then dictate or dictate, you know, the kind of access that we have, the kind of opportunities that we have, the kind of information that we have, etc., right? And also the, it also allows us to interrogate and analyze power and our relationship with the state. And this, of course, is very, very important for queer people and many, many marginalized groups, and where we live, you know, especially for us, when interrogating our power with the state is extremely important for queer people and marginalized groups, especially because a lot of us live under the state of criminalization or heavy persecution by the state, right? And it's also important for us to understand like how these state structures can then have such an overwhelming impact on all areas of our lives, right? So for me, I think the queer feminist analysis really gives us a framework to interrogate the power dynamics, the power dynamics within society and, you know, our power relationship with the state. And also it reminds ourselves that, you know, we ourselves have power to transform our experiences collectively and individually.
Yeah, I love that answer. And, you know, I do think utilizing Foucault, because you mentioned Foucault, and obviously with the whole biopolitics, society of control, well, that's Deleuze. But still, I think it really ties together how the systemic and structural factors are really embedded deep within our day-to-day lives and our lived experiences. And yeah, queer feminist theory with all of these ideas, all of these thoughts can really enlighten us how we can take back power and how power affects us in our day-to-day relations with the state, but also with each other within the marginalized communities themselves, which I think is a very fascinating thing to continue to research, to move forward on. But I'd like to take it a little bit more concrete now. Can you tell us more about the current situation in Malaysia, Tilaga?
I think there are many structural and systemic issues in Malaysia that hinder an inclusive society and by extension, an inclusive Southeast Asia. And specific to the work that we do, the work that I do, which is on LGBTIQ and gender diverse related rights and issues. LGBT people and gender diverse people in Malaysia increasingly face state-sponsored exclusion through various means, right? This includes criminalization, pathologization, demonization, especially religious condemnation and rejection, censorship, regulations of access to various spaces, right? So including and specifically trans people's access to religious spaces, and regulation of gender expression, gender relations, and gender in general, right? I can go on and on naming all of these different types of systemic and structural issues that we face, because there's just quite a lot, and they're all very much interlinked, right? Because the criminalization of LGBT people then, you know, allows for censorship to take place and regulation of all of our lives, right? The demonization and religious condemnation of LGBT people then also allows criminalization and censorship, regulation of our religious practices, etc. So I think there is like definitely the interconnectedness of it all. And again, the reality is all of our lives, and I mean, the reality is our lives and rights are interconnected. When one group of people are oppressed, you know, we are all oppressed, right? Of course, there are different degrees to this, but the spillover effect of oppression is there on all people nevertheless, right? And I think the exclusion and persecution of LGBTIQ and gender diverse people have an impact on how gender is constructed as a whole, and fundamentally how cis-heteropatriarchy continues to dominate sociopolitical and economic structures, right? In today's politics, I think the rights of LGBTIQ people, migrants, and other minorities are central to populist politics. And of course, some of these things are ideologically driven, and some of these ideas are, of course, you know, based on some of these ideas of exclusion have been ingrained in people for years through patriarchal interpretation of religion, social constructs, etc. Right? But if I were to look at, like, you know, the context of Malaysia, we can see how LGBT phobia is exploited and weaponized by political parties and society at large. And this then increases anti-LGBT sentiments, right, that have been ingrained in people for years. And in this context, even people who typically take a progressive stance on human rights issues take a conservative position, right? Or worse, join in the chorus of rejecting or excluding LGBT people because they want to appease to the general sentiment, and also because of the political cost, etc. So in this sense, then, LGBT people face total exclusion and we face total impunity. And, you know, especially in the context where we are already criminalized and, you know, marginalized, right? And this, of course, has a direct impact on, you know, public life, LGBT people's public life, public participation, and also our ability to participate in formal democracy, for example, running for elections and such, and how people want to engage in politics in general, right? For example, through our research, we find among LGBT people, there's a high level of disillusionment and people don't necessarily see a value in voting or participating in democracy, given that they don't see any positive impacts on their lives, right? Even though they go vote every 5 years or so. But of course, I also don't want to limit democracy to just voting and election. But in general, through our research, some of the things that we find is that people face high level of self-censorship. So, you know, engaging in public discourse on social media in and of itself is a huge challenge. And also, you know, given the general politics of it all, people also, we also see high level of desire for people to migrate or seek asylum to places where there are better policies and laws for LGBT people.
Rani, what are your thoughts on this? Because it is, I don't know, I'm at a loss on how to, you know, respond to this, because it is, like, very true and it's very palpable. Pretty similar here in Indonesia as well about about, you know, LGBT people, queer people being very much excluded, and also the self-censorship, the whole thing about exploiting homophobia and transphobia for political gains, appeasing to the general public by being anti-queer. So it's a lot, right? Rani, what does your research say, especially because, you know, you did like categorize all of these various problems and challenges into three main issues, which is like the law and their enforcement, the threats of freedom of expression, and the rise of religious fundamentalism. Let's maybe hear from you on how you see these problems and how you see your own categorization and your own research for these problems.
Well, in progetting the power, the phrase from Tilagai, I think it resonates with this research, because we are trying to do that based on the perspectives of the activists that we are engaging with. So what we see, even based on, like, only on one answer of Tilagai, we can just, like, reflect that this system, this heteropatriarchy embedded in our, like, states or nations, totally impact our whole life, you know, like, structurally and systematically. So in this publication, in this research, we want to understand why up until now the struggle is still is still here. You know, we are still struggling for our gender rights. We are still struggling for having gender justice embedded in our democracy, because feminist movement, gender justice movement, they have been around specifically in Southeast Asia context even since 19th and 20th century, and it was really embedded in our anti-colonial and early nationalist movement. So it must have been something very big that we are facing, and it's also part of our colonization history. So I can say that turns out structurally and systematically we are bound into this heteropatriarchy, because drawing again from our participants' opinion and experience, it has always been the state actors that maintain this heteropatriarchy intact in our countries, and it is then reflected on how they do it structurally by enacting laws that violate human rights, specifically gender rights, and how they systematically maintain this structure by creating an environment that is not safe for those who are vocal to express themselves. So it can come with the form of, again, draconian laws, and then also in the form of like internet like attacks, like online attacks, police attacks, tear gas, and even like in some countries, like specifically, for example, in Philippines, they have like red tagging. So yeah, as I mentioned in the explainer, it's just like a game, like what we are facing, that if we are going to like understand this more into like quite a simplistic form. So just think as this laws is part of the like rule of the game that we are playing, and systematically all of us, like us as the player of the game, we don't only have the rules or the laws, but we also have like the environment, like all the things that we have in the game that also shape us to play the game. You know what I mean? So it's just like structurally the laws are there, but systematically they also like shape our environment, and they also have the things or the tool to keep us play the role that we need to play as citizen, that needs to like obey the government. So for example, in Indonesia we have the new criminal code that will be effective in 2026, some provisions may lead, of course, to the over-criminalization of women and marginalized genders, gender diverse, and also human rights advocate. For example, we also have the health bill that, of course, not only worsen the situations for women, but also those sexual and gender-based violence victims and gender diverse individuals. And because it is national law, it can serve as the basis for its derivative legal products, and also even the understanding. It shapes our understanding as citizens that can further shape the discrimination towards women and also gender diverse individuals more concretely as it operates at a more specific level. So yeah, as we have the new criminal code that we have like very, very like specific clause, for example, like article that restrict anyone other than medical providers from disseminating information about contraception to children or abortion, and then article that prohibits extramarital sex, criminalize immoral sex, something like that. Systematically, we also have something that we are facing. For example, again in Indonesian context, we have the internet bill. The UU ITE bill that, of course, will hinder so many people to speak in online, because, well, I guess nowadays people are more and more people are talking in online basis, and this kind of law will effectively hinder or prevent us to speak. And again, what I want to say as well, not to forget that we also have our, if I can say, like, long overdue victory, because we also have in Indonesia, we have the sexual violence bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tilaga, we have the Anti-Sexual Harassment Act in Malaysia, we have like Gender Equality Act in Thailand, we have even like specific clauses of equal rights or anti-discrimination in countries like Laos or Cambodia. But again, the thing that we need to ensure is the enforcement of it, because yeah, speaking with the activists that are working in these issues and working closely with the people, we can say that having laws are not enough, because we need to ensure like the environment that we are working in is safe for us to ensure that this happens and ensure that we can speak ourselves freely. And in the Southeast Asian context, we still have religious fundamentalism that hinders us to do that, because it's not only, for example, hinder us in the public, but also it's also there in the government, it also influences the making of the laws. So yeah, I think again, if I want to speak about this, I think we need to have like longer session of this talk. But what I want to say precisely is what we are facing is like really big, and it also underlines the intersectionality, because if we're going to talk about gender rights, it's not only about gender, you know, it's not only about men, women, it's not only about like gender diverse people, but also the lives of these people, you know, and it's not only about like sexuality or expression, but it's also about the right to live. And if this is something that the state cannot guarantee, I think this is this can serve as an alarm for us to just like continue doing what we're doing to strive this.
Yeah, I like your point about, you know, the role of the law is also to communicate things. It's not just to it's not just about the, I mean, yeah, sometimes the enforce whether a law is enforced or not, that obviously matters, but also the way that it's written there, and the way that what kind of values, what kind of society, what kind of things are we communicating about the society that we live in? So those things are also like not, or even sometimes more important about having laws that say certain things. So yeah, we do have a lot of, I guess, some wins, but also at the same time, major setbacks, as you mentioned. I wanna hear from Tilaga. Do you see these things? Do you see these like little new bills and you know, and stuff like that across Southeast Asia as wins that are worth celebrating, for example? Or like maybe some of them are, maybe some of them are not, maybe some of them look positive but actually are not that positive, are not that liberatory in the end. Yeah, but and at the same time, I want to ask your thoughts on the fact that in Malaysia, for example, there are already there are still Sharia laws which authorize the use of caning as punishment, and also other kinds of draconian laws that are still being practiced there that are against, you know, clearly in violation of human rights and stuff like that. So yeah, at the same time, it's a whole massive thing. There are little progress, there's lots of setbacks, there's still those draconian laws there. Yeah, what are the attempts to, if there are like attempts to fight back against those laws, and how would you contextualize your own fight, your own work in amidst all of these yeah, all of these laws, all of these setbacks, but also small little progresses.
Yeah, thanks so much. And firstly, I also really agree with Rani's very eloquent analysis, right, of the situation in Southeast Asia. I completely agree with how the points on religious fundamentalism and how pervasive and systemic they are and how they are in all areas of our lives. One, reinforcing cisgender patriarchy and also limiting participation and representation of different groups of people. And at the same time, increasing risks for people when they do participate in public life. Right? So it's such a catch-22 situation. And I really agree with Rani's analysis. And I think like also really how it was centered. I mean, I also agree with the point that how the rise of the gender binary ideology and feminist pushback through religious fundamentalism is quite critical in some of our in some countries in Southeast Asia, right? Especially Malaysia, Indonesia, I think, and some other places. I for me, like as a, you know, I'm in the business of optimism, right? And in the business of hope when I, as a human rights defender. So for me, I believe that a human rights win anywhere is a human rights win everywhere, right? The same as human rights violation, you know, somewhere is a problem. You know, when there's a human rights violation somewhere, that means there's human rights violation everywhere. So the fact that I think there are these new laws, like, for example, I think yesterday there was a discussion around marriage equality in Thailand and also, you know, some different progresses in other places. I think these do give us a sense of hope that, you know, things are changing, not just in the West, but also here in Southeast Asia. And it makes it really tangible and possible, right? It feels like, oh, okay, the work that we do can amount to like change. So I think these are like definitely you know, hopeful things for people to continue to do the work that they, the good work that they do, right? But at the same time, as you've rightly pointed out, like, you know, for LGBT people, especially, some of these wins can be really tricky, right? Like, for example, if we see in Singapore, where there was decriminalization, but then at the same time, there was a safeguard that was put in place to ensure that marriage equality is not accorded to like LGBT people at the moment, right? So, you know, again, there's all of these concessions and all of these negotiations that take place for LGBT people, right? Even in the context of Thailand, I think there was a lot of discussion with among LGBT groups, especially the pro-democracy LGBT groups and the, you know, non-pro-democracy groups, I guess. You know, and in terms of how do, you know, do we want protection of LGBT people and these laws in the context of, you know, lack of democracy for all people. So I think for LGBT people, you know, these wins are not easy. These wins are, can be very difficult. But nonetheless, I think, you know, I want to appreciate the amount of work that these wins, you know, the amount of work that LGBT groups and people have put in so that they can get these wins, right? So even though they are tricky, they are meaningful, these are all very complex emotions that we have to deal with. so that's that. And but at the same time, I think, you know, when there are good models in one country or anywhere, I think this then opens up doors for like people in hostile environments, right? Like, for example, if I look back at my own experience doing human rights work in Malaysia, I think when decriminalization in India happened, that was such a hopeful moment for all of us. And it really opened the, it really opened up the, I guess, I guess it really opened up the imagination for a lot of people to say that, oh, well, you know, if this can happen in India, then it can also happen in Malaysia or like in other places, right? So I think I am always quite hopeful to see, okay, you know, to see legal reform in other places, because this then can open up imagination for other people in other places. And also it provides like concrete, like legal precedents or arguments that people can model after, right? I guess if it wasn't for the Tudun's case in Australia, we would have still had limited, you know, discourse around how to challenge, you know, criminalization of quote unquote same sex activities or like carnal intercourse or whatever they call it, right? So I feel like same goes to like, you know, the NALSA decision, how that then opened up the conversation around legal protection for transgender people. So I think like some of these legal reforms do give us language, do give us framework, do give us arguments that we can use ourselves in our context. So I think these are good stuff. I also think that, you know, speaking of like legal challenges, one of the, you know, as you pointed out, you know, in Malaysia, there are at least 52 state Sharia laws that criminalize LGBT people on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, consensual sex among between adults, among others, right? So, and then on top of that, we have the Section 377A(b) that criminalize carnal intercourse. So in Malaysia, you know, there's a lot of criminalization of like LGBT people. And you know, in the last 10 years or so, you know, together with LGBT groups in Malaysia, including Justice for Sisters, have supported several strategic litigation efforts to assess the constitutionality of these anti-LGBT laws and state action. So we've also not just undertaken strategic litigation of these bad laws, but also, you know, state actions banning books, for example. And, you know, we have been successful in some cases, and it has set good legal precedents for similar challenges, not just limited to, you know, challenges that involve LGBT people, right? Currently, there is a challenge in the federal court in Malaysia that is looking at the constitutionality of several provisions within the Kelantan Sharia enactment. And this is using the legal precedents of the Ike Putra legal precedents, which is in the Ike Putra case, Ike Putra challenged the constitutionality of Section 28 of the Selangor Sharia enactment, which criminalized sex against the order of nature. So a group of men were arrested, and they were charged for attempt of sex against the order of nature, right? And there was no proof of them having sex. There was no proof of them, you know, doing anything non-consensual. However, they were charged in court for, you know, attempt of sex against the order of nature. And out of that, some of the folks who pleaded guilty were caned. You know, they were caned, I think, maybe five or six times. And one of them, Ike Putra, then, you know, challenged the law in the federal court a few years ago and got a very good decision. And this decision then has a reverberating impact on at least 10 to 13 laws that criminalizes the same subject matter, right? So I would say this is one successful legal challenge that we've had, and how the positive impact that it has had on the legal framework in Malaysia. And I guess like we've also seen some of the legal challenges that we have undertaken, although it may have not been successful at all levels. I guess by the virtue of mounting these challenges, I think one of the things that we have seen, positive impact that we have seen, is that we've seen more visibility of trans activism, for example, and visibility on the human rights issues that trans people face. Because, you know, for example, when we supported the legal challenge of Section 66 of the Negeri Sembilan Sharia enactment, that challenge basically opened up people's consciousness to the kind of violation that trans people face on a daily basis, right? And the kind of arbitrary arrest and the kind of humiliation that people face for being themselves. So I think even though we were not successful at the end, when we got to the federal court, you know, the decision was, the Court of Appeals decision, which was a progressive decision, was overturned on technicality. But, you know, the fact that through the legal challenge, I think we were able to open up people's minds and, you know, to some degree. And it really raised the consciousness of, you know, the situation of trans people in Malaysia. So I think those are some things. I know I've gone on for too long with this response. And I think other than that, we've also taken up legal analysis of discriminatory laws. And I think the legal analysis are important. You know, for me personally, it's important because we need to have a good understanding of what are the problems with the law, right? Because if we don't have a good understanding of, like, what is it? What is the problem? Then it's very difficult for us to, like, explain these problems to other people, right? And how it impacts our lives. So we have to undertake legal analysis and such. And we also, you know, constantly make it a point to raise awareness about how bad laws have an impact on all areas of our lives, right? Like in Malaysia, especially because there's the Sharia laws and the civil laws. You know, sometimes people assume that just because some of these anti-LGBT laws within the Sharia system or under the Sharia state laws, people think that it doesn't affect non-Muslim people, right? But it does. And of course, that's not true, right? Of course, it has an impact on all people, including non-Muslim people, because one, it creates an environment of criminalization and creates an environment of impunity. And also, it creates an impact, it creates an environment where nobody is going to get rights, right? Like, we see how, like, the there is a fatwa against trans people that was introduced in 1982, I believe. And in this fatwa, it says that, you know, trans people are prohibited or haram, right? And this fatwa then has had a huge impact, a systemic impact on the availability of trans-specific healthcare for all people. And the, you know, ability for trans people to have legal gender recognition, right? Regardless of religion and race. So I think it's a, you know, sometimes people assume that just because, you know, it's Sharia laws, it really doesn't have an impact on non-Muslim people, but it does, right? And I think this is something that, you know, we also try to tell, you know, we constantly try to raise awareness around, right? I'm also happy to share with you both, that we, you know, we also, in relation to the convergent practices that where you talked about, Mukayam, we are also doing some research around that area, and we've published a few research reports. And we're currently developing a knowledge portal or information portal where a lot of these research that we've done is hosted so that it is more accessible to people, so that, you know, we can sort of raise awareness about the issues, the convergent practices issues in Malaysia. And we are also, you know, the term balik ke pangkal jalan or return to the right path is often used against LGBT people to convert us. So we are reclaiming that through this microsite. So we want to guide people to the right path of acceptance, information, and protection, you know? Yeah, so I'm going to stop there. Sorry.
No. I love that. Guiding people back to the right path of going against the order of nature. I think that's perfect. So, yeah. No, but I think there's this through line that I think you mentioned a lot of times also, and Rani has also mentioned about the effects that laws have on all people, not like directly, not only the people who's directly affected by it, like directly supposed to be affected by it, but also how new progress, how, you know, advocacy work can, successful advocacy work, or even the ones that are still being done, are, you know, can open up new imaginations, new consciousness, raising all of these consciousness about what, yeah, if it's possible in India, then why not in Malaysia and all of those things, right? I do think that's very, very important. And at the same time as doing research on all of these effects and all of these laws and stuff like that. So thank you so much for sharing that. I guess my question now, and Rani, you can follow up on this next, but still to Thilaga, is that if other researchers like Rani, like other people, like some of the listeners listening here, if researchers would like to help with advocacy work, what kind of research is actually needed for advocacy, for like the progress of human rights? So how can allied researchers help in this effort, do you think, Thilaga?
So my simple answer is all kinds of research. So I think all kinds of research is useful, right? Because we need both qualitative research, we need quantitative research, and we also need a mix of that. But I think it's also very important when we do research, and this is something that I remember my lecturer saying at one point, that we want to do research with people, not on people, right? So, and I think that's the principle of, like, again, we go back to feminist research principles, right? Where we want to make sure that when we are doing research, that we are equalizing power and we are giving people power to tell their stories, and for them to know that, you know, their stories is going to have a transformative impact, right? As a researcher myself, I truly believe in the power of evidence and our experiences, and I believe in the power of information, right? Especially in hostile contexts. Because I think when it comes to, especially in hostile contexts, it's very, very difficult for people to share their stories because of the risk, as we've talked about a lot, right? Like as what Rani mentioned, in the context of religious fundamentalism, OGBV or online gender-based violence is extremely high. Self-censorship is extremely high, right? So people are alienated from each other and, you know, and find it very difficult to, participate in public discourse, right? So in this context, it is research can really help reduce the risk for people to share their stories and also their experiences, right? And I think in a hostile context, it's really important when we can highlight through trend studies or like by consolidating these experiences that, you know, one, our experiences are not taking place in isolation. And two, these experiences are so similar, right? And that also allows us to interrogate why are these experiences so similar, right? So I think like to me, especially in a hostile context, I fully encourage researchers to like do all kinds of research, but using a feminist principle, using feminist research principles, and also, you know, with the intention of giving back power to the people and to the communities that they work with.
Yeah, I like that. And that's also very much aligned with what we're trying to do here in New Narrative. Over to you, Rani. What are your thoughts on this?
Actually, what Thilaga have said is very powerful as well. But what I want to say is, again and again, what we are facing now, the heteropatriarchal system, is very, very powerful. And in order to face that, or even better, to dismantle this heteropatriarchal system that underlies various oppression that we experience, we need to have our own evidence. We need to have our materials to push for change. So we need to show people what's going on, and we need to try our best to show it based on the people who experience it firsthand. So that's where research comes in handy, because as Tilaga said, it's centering the people, people's power. Like research, I think research work is there to dig that up, to gather the various perspectives of people to show that they are not powerless. The power is within all of us. And then the research is there to bring these power, these voices for people to understand more and spark more discussion and spark inspirations because we are researching with people. So I think our research, and I believe the research that has been done by Justice for Sisters, and as well as like many gender justice movements in Southeast Asia, I think this is the way that we show it, because I realized that, of course, one research cannot cover everything that we want to show, but it is one of the first steps that we can do to understand what's going on. And it also serves as an evidence that there are so many things that we need to improve. And in this context is our democracy. And I think what's more important about research is it can bring more and more people to engage in this issue because I guess, yeah, as I said, one research cannot cover everything, and it also gives us a lot of room to discuss and improve the way we see things. As, for example, as Tilaga previously said, that we need to like discuss or elaborate more, examine more about the laws. Again, I am not experienced in law. I'm like a qualitative researcher with a background in philosophy and anthropology. So I guess like understanding much like deeper about law is not my forte, but this means that this research can engage a lot of people, for example, like people with the expertise of law to like understand more. So we can like work hand in hand in our like solidarity. And it also serve as hope, I guess, because as a researcher and activist myself, I sometimes find it very devastating to read research about like so many like bad things happening around me and regionally, especially about like democracy and gender justice. But it also sparks hope within me, because it means that I am not alone in this journey. It means that there are so many people that are working with me with our own power. And if we can combine it together because we read and do research, I think that must be like very amazing.
Yeah, I love how the perspective is now. I think it's very important that everyone adopts this perspective, is that you don't research... You research with people, not on people, but that means that you research not to extract information from people, but to give them a safe space to tell their stories and their lived experiences. And I feel like that's very a very powerful, but also a very powerful and transformative, and but sadly not, you know, it's not done enough. I don't think it's really ever done enough with the whole issues that we are facing right now. So I'm mindful of time. So let's just tie this back to your initial thoughts, Rani, earlier in this podcast, in this conversation, you mentioned about building transnational solidarity. So tying back to your answer just now about the role of research to give hope, to give in your own work, how would then that contribute to building transnational solidarity? And also for the non-researchers out there, what can they do to help this process of building this solidarity? Maybe help with the research, maybe help amplify the research results, maybe help with the advocacy work. This is a question for both Rani and Tilaga. But let's hear from you, Rani. What are your thoughts on this?
Thank you, Bonnie. Yeah, I think, well, firstly, it is not my place to say like how everyone should act based on research, for example. But I believe by doing research, to answer your first question, by doing research, it means that we are trying to understand the particular issues like more deeply, and I guess by doing research, it means that we also engage with a lot more people. So this means that our knowledge is not like isolated. Like we can like gather inspirations from the people that we are researching or working with, and I guess this kind of research, reflecting to this particular like research project, because the third explainer, the upcoming explainer, will also talk about like transnational movement building. I guess this kind of research will, I think it is important to not only understand, but also to center and also give the platform for those who needs to speak, for those who have the voice, but they cannot like put it like anywhere, for example. It means that we are trying to achieve that democracy itself by doing this research, because we pass the mic to the people that needs to speak out loud, speak their voices. And about transnational movement building or any kind of like movement building, and also to answer the second question, I think by doing this research, the first thing, because the research itself is trying to understand more, then by reading the research, it's like the first step to understand what we have been doing so far. And after that, what we can do together is, of course, it's based on our expertise and also our context, but I guess it's also important to just keep talking, keep voicing out the issue, because we need not to be silent. I think it's very important to just like keep talking about the issue. And I think this research has taught me, by understanding my own context as an Indonesian feminist activist and researcher, and by then understanding the context of like Southeast Asia, and then understanding like the similarities and differences between like each context, I think that's also the way we can do things. I mean, like, we understand our context first, and then we can collaborate, or like, I don't think compare is the best word, but like, yeah, just seeing the similarities and also differences between our context, so that we can gather our power to create something. And that something, I think it is up to us. I mean, I am not the person who needs to talk, but whatever the form is, I think research is the first and important step to like gather all the powers that we have, because we try to understand, we try to seek the similarities and differences amongst us. And yeah, I think that's how powerful research is.
Yeah, I like that, contextualizing our struggles, as you did with in the context of Indonesians, and then the rest of Southeast Asia. Yeah, that can be pretty powerful. Thilaga, what are your thoughts on this?
I just really want to thank Rani and colleagues and folks at New Narrative for the work that you folks are doing. I think it's really quite amazing that you know, there is a platform for us to really do feminist research and also amplify the feminist research through different ways, right? Through articles, through podcasts, through so many different things. So I think, you know, I feel like we're in a time where we are able to not just research, but also make our findings more accessible to people. So I think this is really quite heartening for me, because like, a few years ago, I remember being in conversation about us, like, being in conversation where we were talking about you know, we cannot just do research and just keep it on bookshelves. We need to like bring it to the people. So I think the fact that we are doing this and making things more information more accessible and more democratic, I think that's something really great. I also think that I completely agree with everything that Rani has said in terms of like contextualizing the struggle and like research being the first step to consolidating power of like people and evidence and experiences and things like that. I'm also like Rani quite hopeful. And I also love the Southeast Asian solidarity. You know, I've been part of the ASEAN People's Forum and other Southeast Asian convenings. And I know the kind of analysis, the kind of discussions that take place in these spaces. And I think like, and I'm always very inspired by the Southeast Asian people and the things that they deal with, right? Because, you know, a lot of people are dealing with authoritarian governments. A lot of people are dealing with environmental issues and really serious issues within this region. So I'm really happy to see how there are more platforms to not just like the physical forums, but also there are more online spaces and offline spaces that are coming up to like, you know, highlight some of the stories and have these regional conversations, right? And I'm also like really happy, like truly, truly, truly very happy to be in this conversation with Rani as well, because I think these are the kind of conversations that we need. And I'm really glad that New Narrative is providing this platform, because in years of like working with colleagues in Southeast Asia, I think one of the things that, you know, I kept hearing, or the recurring thing that I've always heard from people, is that, you know, what we need is really more spaces for us to have discussion and exchanges, to learn from each other, right? So I think, like Rani said, not dictating what people need to do, but just facilitating these spaces for conversations, I think would be really critical in the changes that we want to see. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Tilaga, and thank you, Rani. This has been an amazing conversation. We've gone like quite a bit past the 1 hour mark, which is, yeah, I'm sure we can go on. But yeah, this has been exciting. So thank you so much for your time. And that wraps up our discussion with Oktaria Asmarani and Tilaga Sulatire. We went way past our regular time since the discussion was so exciting for us, and we hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. The most important takeaway for me is how legal battles and advocacy work aren't just about rules and laws, but about starting conversations and opening up people's imaginations about the limits of what's possible in our civil society. Which is also why it's very important for us to contextualize our struggles. Whatever we're going through, we're not alone. Our struggles are always part of systemic and structural issues in our country, with echoes throughout the region and perhaps worldwide and throughout history. So start those conversations and build that solidarity. If you'd like to know more about Justice for Sisters project against conversion therapy, you can check out Balik ke Pangkal Jalan in the link in our show notes. If you have similar or related work that you're working on, give us a shout out. We're all in this together. My name is Bonibel Ramatan, and this has been Southeast Asia Dispatches, brought to you by New Narrative and produced by Dania Yudo. I'll see you around.